This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You've heard of Leonardo, Michelangelo, Galileo, Newton, maybe even Pascal and Hooke, all Renaissance men who, between them, innovated in painting, sculpture, physics, math, chemistry, astronomy, architecture, philosophy. The list goes on. But how about Athanasius Kircher? Yeah, ever heard of him? Not ringing, no bells are ringing. Well, he was a contemporary of many of these greats and a priest and a scholar who studied Egyptian hieroglyphics, magnetism, philosophy, music. He studied the blood of plague victims through an early microscope. He even hiked into the smoking crater of Mount Vesuvius to pursue his study of volcanoes and magma. Maybe a little crazy, like a lot of other pioneers. Impressive resume, right? The only problem is he got a lot of stuff wrong. Whoops. You can read about his misadventures in my next guest's new book, A Man of Misconceptions, The Life of an Eccentric in an Age of Change. Very entertaining. John Glassie is the author of A Man of Misconceptions and a former contributing editor at the New York Times Magazine. He joins us in our New York studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much.
Tell us about why don't we have heard of this guy? Did all that stuff? We never heard of him.
Well, it's a good question. And historians have become increasingly interested in him in the last couple of decades, I would say. But there wasn't a popular sort of version of his story out there. So that was one reason why I felt like I had to do it. I think he isn't a household name or even remembered, mainly because he didn't have one single achievement that he could be remembered for, but he did play a pretty significant role in many different fields.
But if he was wrong in so many of them, how can he play a role in those fields?
Well, there are a couple of different ways, maybe, in which that could be. One is I've begun to feel a little bit guilty about the title of my book, A Man of Misconceptions, because I'm very fond of this fellow.
And yes. It's growing on you.
Yes, absolutely. Well, after working on it for some time, that's probably what happens. But, he wasn't wrong about everything. He was a man of misconceptions, certainly, but that's kind of a conceit that through the course of the book I begin to undermine, or I think the book itself begins to undermine, because you realize that many of his misconceptions were misconceptions of the time. Many people held them, and they're misconceptions really from our modernist point of view. This was just a crazy, crazy time. So it's really about a kind of perspective. It's a mindset that I was trying to sort of get into with the story of this fellow.
Give us a flavor of the time, then. What was going on among his peers and then going on in the world at that time?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can start off, he was born on the eve of a witch hunt. And
not a good start.
In 1602, And he was steeped in a lot of the mystical and magical thinking of the pre-scientific era. 1602, that's several years before Galileo published Starry Messenger, his observations of the four moons around Jupiter and so on. And he died in 1680. That was several years before Newton published the Principia. So he lived 78 years, whatever that was. This is really the period that we now have a two-word label for, the scientific revolution. Mm-hmm. So he was steeped in these older notions, but he actually did, he was an early adopter of technologies like the celestial tube, as they called it, or the telescope, the microscope. But he was probably still too steeped in the older methodologies to really make too much progress.
The world was changing, or just changing around him, and
absolutely.
He couldn't keep up with it.
Yeah. Although he certainly tried. I mean, this guy had more energy than I've ever, you can imagine. And he published something like 30 books and almost as many subjects. You mentioned a lot of them,
right?
And he those books actually served as sort of benchmarks of learning of the time. There were encyclopedias on whatever it was, optics, even music, that kind of thing. And even though they contained many propositions that could then be proven wrong by experiment, which is, by the way, a pretty valuable service in a way, they were important works that almost all the major figures of that time had to contend with.
Mm-hmm. You've likened him to a kind of Forrest Gump of the 17th century.
I have, yeah. I mean, well, the only difference is that Forrest Gump, was this innocent, naive, had a kind of pure quality to his character. Kierke was a courtier, a careerist. He was not above fibbing if it suited him to get ahead in his career. But he was, in the way that Forrest Gump was, kind of one or two degrees of separation away from so many kind of characteristic moments of the time, and then also as well as people. So, as I say, born on the eve of a witch hunt, he was kind of thrown around in the turmoil of the 30 Years' War. Mm-hmm. He arrived in Rome in 1633, just months after the Galileo trial. He was in Rome in 1656 for the plague. You mentioned the plague.
Yeah.
And
he survived.
Well, he survived, yeah. Well, they actually, the entire city went, they had a fairly sophisticated sort of system in place to try and shut it down. And 15,000 people died in Rome, apparently, at that time. At the same time, in Naples, something like 150,000 to 250,000 people died. So Rome actually had a very sophisticated system in place. But he did survive that, and that's when he looked at the blood of plague victims under a microscope, which was probably the first time ever looked at the blood, human blood, through a microscope.
And what did he actually examine? Did he make an observation and a contribution after the observation?
Well, he did. It's not clear how sophisticated the microscope was that he was using, mm-hmm. whether it was a compound microscope even, and it's not clear entirely what he saw. But he claimed to have seen an innumerable number of invisible little worms, and he determined from that plague and that all disease was a living thing. And so he's been – there's a debate. I've said, I don't know – it's ongoing. I don't know how active it is, about whether he should be given credit for the germ theory of disease.
Instead of Pasteur, who came later.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, so he saw something. He didn't know what they were, but he thought that's how this spread from one person to another, through these little worms or something.
That's right. And this actually was connected to his – he has sort of an animistic kind of view of the world, and it was connected to something that he called universal sperm, this notion that there were little seed-like things. The life force was out and about in almost everything. Hmm. Kind of bizarre.
Hmm. Talking with John Glassy, author of A Man of Misconceptions, The Life of an Eccentric in an Age of Change. Is it true that Kircher actually coined the term electromagnetism?
Well, yes. I thought so until today when I was checking it, and it looks like...
Never quite ever done with anything. I know how that is. Yeah.
Well, no, it's I think so, and there's a general consensus mm-hmm. that yes, although, but as I say, I saw something today that suggests that maybe William Gilbert, who wrote about magnetism, he wrote this mm-hmm. important work in 1601 about magnetism. But it's not the amazing coinage that we sort of think of in a way. Electron is the Greek word for amber,
right,
and it's which when you rub it, against different materials or whatever create static electricity. So this was, just a way of describing a phenomenon that he saw was related to magnetic attraction mm-hmm. and repulsion.
Mm-hmm. This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. Tell me the story about the sunflower seed clock, something that I think might be better suited to Ripley's Believe It or Not than the halls of science.
Yes. Well, It's a great story. He He came out, he arrived in France in 1633. If I go on too long, just you'll have to just mm-hmm. stop me.
I love these stories. Go ahead.
He arrived in France in 1633 after sort of as a refugee from the 30 Years' War and came into the fold of some French sort of experimental philosophers. And he talked up the sunflower seed clock to them.
A clock made out of sunflower seeds.
What it was is that the seed was supposed to be able to drive the clock. And the idea was that that in the same way that the sunflower, the flower itself, turns and follows the sun during the course of the day, that the seed had the same property. He actually attributed it to a kind of magnetic attraction of the sun.
Hmm.
He believed this connects again to almost this notion of universal sperm that I was talking
to you.
These invisible energies, these kind of cosmic influences and attractions and repulsions. So the notion was that the seed contained, you know, was pulled by the sun to drive a clock. The seed was embedded in a cork in a tub of water, and it was shown in certain cases, you know, when he displayed it, to no matter which way, whatever you did with the cork, it would go right back and display the accurate time.
Wow!
But it was really a parlor trick because there was also a magnet embedded in the cork. And so if he had enough time beforehand to set this parlor trick up before people arrived to see it, he would figure out relative to magnetic north where the sun would be, and he would set it up so that it would always show the correct time.
Was there money on these things riding it? was he going to make any money from, you know,
well,
from being a charlatan in that sense?
It's funny. You know, I mean, I think that what he wanted to do was I think he wanted to try to convey what he actually believed the truth was about the way the universe worked, that there were indeed these kinds of energies. And even if he could not make a sunflower seed drive a clock,
couldn't prove it legitimately.
It was an analogy. This was the kind of thing that he wanted people to understand. Well, this happened to be at the time of the Galileo trial, by the way. And people kind of twigged on this as a way that, you know, maybe there was something here. If this was true, then maybe this could actually help make Galileo's case that the sun had this attractive power. And so among sort of French intellectuals, there was a bunch of correspondence. Mersenne, now famous for his prime numbers, wrote to Descartes and talked to him about this. And Descartes responded, said, well, thank you very much for having written to me about this. I find this to be very fascinating. If it's true, it's certainly, you know, very curious and wonderful, although I'm not convinced that this is the case. Although I don't hold it to be impossible.
Yeah.
And then, in fact, even years later, when Kircher published his major work on magnetism, Descartes read sort of an enhanced description of the sunflower seed clock, and wrote to I don't know if it was Constantine or Christian Huygens right in my mind right now, but he had correspondence about this, and he said, you know, I've heard about this sunflower seed clock, but several years ago, Father, you know, Mersenne wrote to me about it. I still don't think it's possible, on and on and on, but he was making it sound as if it was completely absurd, but it wasn't so absurd that he didn't want to try it himself. So Descartes tried this thing itself. Well, it turns out, of course, it did not work.
Yeah, of course not. This is Science Friday from NPR, talking with John Glassie, author of A Man of Misconceptions, The Life of an Eccentric in an Age of Change. And speaking of an eccentric, you write in him about how he hiked into the smoking crater of Mount Vesuvius.
Indeed he did.
Everybody's a little nutty.
Well, not to mention, this is in the aftermath of a devastating earthquake in 1638 in southern Italy there. He had been down in Malta and on Sicily exploring the caves, the catacombs, the grottos, the inland seas, the underground passageways, and so forth. And he was beginning to develop theories about the interior of the earth.
So he went down there to explore.
So he went down there. There was only one way to find out.
Go down there and take a hike.
Get some empirical evidence and go on down.
Wasn't he afraid of the lava or anything that might come out of that?
Well, I think he was, but you know, look, he was a crackpot, but he was someone who had genuine passion for knowledge. He had sort of the right idea. Mm-hmm. As far as that goes. Mm-hmm. He describes, there's this great passages about that exploration. He said that he felt that he was, facing the habitation of hell, and he describes the sulfurous odors, mm-hmm. and the noisome racket of the rocks falling into the molten lava and so forth. It's fantastic.
So he was actually that close to the lava.
Well, I don't know how close he was, frankly, but it was inside the crater Vesuvius that I think he really began to develop his notion of what the interior of the Earth was like. And these were theories that he ended up publishing, I guess, about 30 years later in a major mm-hmm. work called Mundus Subterraneus. Which means just subterranean right. world or underground world, and that was kind of a major work of what we call geology. and he published these wonderful sort of schematic diagrams of the Earth with networks of fires and also oceans leading all the way down into the center of the Earth.
Oceans of lava.
Oceans of water.
Of water leading down into the center of the Earth.
There was a symbiotic system going on there in his mind.
Wow. Well, if you want to, we've run out of time, but you want to read lots more about this, I highly recommend reading John Glassy's book, A Man of Misconceptions, The Life of an Eccentric in the Age of Change. And that guy is, Athanasius.
Athanasius.
See, I got to close. Athanasius Kircher.
That's right.
Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.